In the following recording by the LA Sound Posse, you will hear John Ross, award-winning journalist, activist, poet, human shield, and globe-trotting troublemaker, presenting a lecture updating the ongoing Zapatista rebellion in Chiapas and its plans for Mexico's 2006 presidential election. The talk was recorded on November 14th of 2005 at the New College Theater in San Francisco, California.
This legendary stuff has got to stop. No, you know, I walked into somebody's house the other day and I heard Larry Bensky on the radio saying, he either said the legendary poet or the alleged poet, but unclear. The title of this talk, and I have been walking around the mission putting up posters endlessly for the last couple of weeks, is Our Dreams Are Not on the Ballot. And actually, we took this title, and I want to, again, thank my great compañera, Elizabeth Bell, for helping us get the leaflet out here and coming up with this as one of the alternatives. Our dreams are not on the ballot. It is an expression that actually comes from the struggle in Argentina in 2002, after the Argentinazo, after the economy had fallen apart. And the picateros, the independents, the people that felt that political voting in political elections was not going to change things in Argentina, raised this slogan that nuestros sueños no están en las urnas. And to me, it really does, in many respects, illustrate and talk about what the Sexta Declaration of the Lacandon Jungle and the Otra Campaña, the other campaign, is all about. And all of us have been thinking, I think, in the last bunch of years, certainly since Florida in 2000, that, you know, elections no longer can guarantee any measure of democracy in this country and virtually in any other countries. They certainly, our dreams are not on those ballots, no? And what is life about if we don't dare to dream, no? And so the Zapatistas at, in, I kind of have my notes backwards, and I think this is not even my notes. I was wondering where they were. Here they are. Yeah. So I think it is really, when we talk about our dreams are not on the ballot, we have to think about that quotient that's called dreaming, no? And the Zapatistas dare to dream. Many of us dare to dream. Many of us dare to dream that another world is possible. We've been saying that for a while. The Zapatistas are indeed building that other world in Chiapas. My new book, which will be out a year from now, is a chronicle of precisely that, this building of this other world, making another world possible. And we've seen this happen in the Zapatista zone over the last couple of years. So I think it's important to understand that some people in this planet are still dreaming and still trying to make those dreams come true, and they don't see their dreams on that piece of paper that they give you to tell you to vote for one millionaire or another millionaire, one power broker or another power broker. Our dreams are not there. Now, I mentioned that we have now a caracol. Caracoles are the cultural and political centers of the Zapatistas. There are five of them in Chiapas. Those of you who have gone to Chiapas have probably gone to Oventico, La Realidad, or Roberto Barrios, or Francisco Gomez, or one of the Morelia, one of the caracoles. No, now we're going to, in the process of putting together a caracol here in the mission. And, you know, a lot of this comes from people that sit around in cafes and say, hey, you know, we can make another world possible. And so this is kind of a project that's grown out of artists and poets around the Café Bohème and here in the community. And I'd like to bring up Walter López El Huracán to help me read the beginning of the Sexta Declaración. And we'll read from it and then go back and talk about what the declaration is and what it represents. So we're going to do this paragraph by paragraph. And aquí, si te quieres, vaya, go on. ¿Listo? Tú primero.
Esta es nuestra palabra sencilla que busca tocar el corazón de la gente humilde y simple como nosotros, pero también como nosotros, digna y rebelde. Esta es nuestra palabra sencilla para contar de lo que ha sido nuestro paso y en dónde estamos ahora. para explicar cómo vemos el mundo y nuestro país, para decir lo que pensamos hacer y cómo pensamos hacerlo, y para invitar a otras personas a que se caminen con nosotros en algo muy grande que se llama México, y algo más grande que se llama mundo. Esta es nuestra palabra, sencilla, para dar cuenta a todos los corazones que son honestos y nobles de lo que queremos en México y el mundo. Esta es nuestra palabra sencilla, porque es nuestra idea el llamar a quienes son como nosotros y unirnos a ellos en todas partes donde viven y luchan.
This is our simple word that seeks to touch the heart of the humble and simple people like us, but also like us, people with dignity, people in rebellion. This is our simple word to tell you the story of our steps and in what we think of doing and how we think about doing it, and to invite other peoples to walk with us in this big place called Mexico. To those with honest and noble hearts to help us in what we want for Mexico and the world. This is our simple word. Our idea is to call upon those who are like us and unite with them and in every place where they live and struggle together.
Esto es lo que somos. Nosotros somos los zapatistas del Ejército Zapatista de Liberación Nacional. Aún también nos dicen neo-zapatistas. Bueno, pues nosotros, los zapatistas del ESSLN, nos levantamos en armas en enero de 94 porque vimos que ya está bueno de tantas maldades que hacen los poderosos, que solo nos humillan, nos roban, nos encarcelan y nos matan, y nada que nadie dice ni hace nada. Por eso nosotros dijimos que ya basta, o sea, que ya no vamos a permitir que nos hacen menos y nos traten peor que como animales.
We are the Zapatistas of the EZLN, although they also call us Neo-Zapatistas. Okay, well, we, the Zapatistas of the EZLN, rose up in arms in January 1994 because we were tired of all the evil the powerful did to us, that they only humiliated us, robbed us, killed us, and no one ever said or did anything. For all that, we said, basta. That is, we weren't going to permit them that they treat us worse than animals anymore.
Y entonces, como dijimos que queremos la democracia, la libertad y la justicia para todos los mexicanos, aún más bien nos concentramos en los pueblos indios, porque resulta que nosotros del ESLN somos casi todos puros indígenas de acá, de Chiapas, pero no queremos luchar solo por su bien de nosotros, o solo por el bien de los indígenas de Chiapas, o solo por los pueblos indios de México, sino que queremos luchar junto con todos los que son gente humilde y simple como nosotros y que tienen gran necesidad y que sufren la explotación y los robos de los ricos y sus malos gobiernos aquí en nuestro México y en otros países del mundo.
And we also said that we wanted democracy, liberty, and justice for all the Mexicans, although mostly then we were talking about the Indian peoples. Because, you see, we of the EZLN are mostly Indian people from the state of Chiapas, although we don't want to struggle alone for our own good or only for the Indian people of Chiapas, but for all of the people of Mexico. And also we want to fight alongside the humble and simple people who are like us and that have the same great necessities and that suffer the exploitation and the thievery of the rich and their bad governments here in Mexico and in the rest of the world.
Y entonces nuestra pequeña historia es que nos cansamos de la explotación que nos hacían los poderosos y pues nos organizamos para defendernos y para luchar por la justicia. Al principio no somos muchos, apenas unos cuantos andábamos de un lado a otro, hablando y escuchando a otras personas como nosotros. Eso hicimos muchos años y lo hicimos en secreto, o sea, sin hacer bulla. O sea, que juntamos nuestra fuerza en silencio. Tardamos como 10 años así, y ya luego, pues nos crecimos, pues ya éramos muchos miles. Entonces nos preparamos bien con la política y las armas y de repente cuando los ricos están echando fiesta de año nuevo, pues les caímos en sus ciudades y ahí nomás las tomamos. Y les dejamos dicho a todos que aquí estamos, que nos tienen que tomar en cuenta.
And so our brief history is that we got tired of being exploited by the powerful and we organized to defend ourselves and fight for justice. At first, we were only a few running from one side to the other, talking and listening to other people who were like us. We did this for many years, and we did it in secret without making any noise. That is, we gathered our forces in silence. It took us about 10 years, but we began to grow, and soon there were many thousands of us. So we prepared ourselves well politically and learned how to use arms. And all of a sudden, when the rich were having their big New Year's Eve fiesta, well, we fell upon them in their cities and let them know that we are here, that from now on they had to take us into account. Gracias, gracias. Gracias, Walter. The Sixth Declaration of the Lacandon Jungle was issued in June of this year. It came after the Zapatistas had called for a red alert, the maximum security precaution that they've taken. They had not called a red alert in many years. They asked all foreigners inside the Zapatista zone to leave the zone. They closed down the operations of the non-government organizations except for the medical components. They asked all the people in the caracoles, in the centers that people gather, to return to their village for an important consultation about the future of the Zapatista Army of National Liberation. It sounded very alarming to those of us that follow the situation, and it seemed somewhat inexplicable as to why the red alert had been called at this moment. There didn't seem to be much pressure from the military. There was some pressure, but it was minimal and it part of the daily living. There didn't seem to be much activity on the part of the paramilitaries in the state of Chiapas. So it was a question as to why the red alert had actually been called. I personally think that the red alert was called to see who was listening, to see how people would react, to see how many people out there would volunteer their energies in terms of what was going to happen next, who was paying attention to the Zapatistas. I received word of the red alert on my screens in mid-June in Istanbul, in Turkey, at the Iraqi War Crimes Tribunal, where there were a great number of people testifying about the war in Iraq and what it has done to the Iraqi people. Very moving and heavy event. And there were a number of people there that I've run into at a lot of different events. Rick Rowley, whose movie we'll see a bit later, the Fourth World War, Rick and Jackie were there. And the moment they heard about the red alert, they got real concerned. We all went off to the internet parlor to see if we could get any further information as to what exactly was going on. We had brought over for the Iraqi War Crimes Tribunal the person who functions as a Zapatista lawyer, Miguel Angel de los Santos, an old compañero, who sat on the jury of the Iraqi War Crimes Tribunal, and Miguel was quite concerned that this meant that there was some military activity up ahead. About 10 days into this wait, because there was a period of time, and you know, you'd look at La Jornada, which carries all the communiques of the Zapatistas, to see if anything had changed from day to day. The Zapatistas informed the public that this was not going to be a military initiative, that whatever evolved from these discussions would be a political initiative. And I began to notice on my screen messages from just everywhere, from Vermont and Amsterdam and San Francisco and Mexico City, asking me, what can we do? How can we help the Zapatistas? So if the red alert was designed to see who was listening, a lot of people certainly were listening and paying attention and wondering what was going to happen next and prepared to defend them. I first saw the sexto was published on the 29th of June, I believe, in La Jornada. It took a couple of days for it actually to be published, and it was published in three installments, and I got to read it, and I remember it was a very dark room with no light on a German keyboard in the Kurdish zone of Turkey, no? And just reading the document, really, it brought tears to my eyes, tears of relief that they were okay, and they came out of this, whatever this process was of the red alert, with a document that was one of the most gorgeous and beautiful documents that I've read in a long time, and that in fact they were about to launch into a new phase of their development. And so half were tears of relief, but also a great amount of emotion at the way the document is written. And as you see, Walter and I just read a bit of the document, the way it begins by the Zapatistas telling their story of how their rebellion occurred. This is not a document written by Subcomandante Marcos. This is a document that was written collectively by the Zapatistas, and the language reveals that, and it's a welcome change in a real sense. Not that Marcos is not a consummate writer and very accurate and pertinent, but to see the Zapatistas actually compose this document in their own writing was to me quite important. This document is, I might say that the declarations of the Lacandon jungles have come at various points in time, but this is the first one in 7 years. The first declaration of the Lacandon jungle was issued January 1st, 1994, when the rebellion began, and pretty much declared war on the Mexican government. Not pretty much, declared war on the Mexican government and indicated what their, you know, what the reasons were. And there were a number of declarations of the Lacandon jungles in the early years of the struggle. The fifth declaration, the last one we saw, came in 1998, in July of 1998, and it broke an 18-month silence on the part of the Zapatistas. So there had not been a declaration in 7 years, and what's included in the sixth then became extremely important. As we read, the first third of the document talks about the Zapatistas' history, and it's really interesting to see how they perceive of their history. The document is imbued from beginning to end with this tremendous sense of solidarity and gratitude for the solidarity that has been extended to the Zapatistas. And at one point, the EZLN says, "Our harvest was good last year, and this year if the military does not intervene, our harvest will be good again. So we want to send corn to our friends in the world. Dos tambos to the people of Cuba. Tambo is about 30 liters. Dos tambos to the people of Cuba. Dos tambos to the Indians of Ecuador. Dos tambos to the people who are fighting for liberty in Bolivia. Dos tambos to the picateros of Argentina who have been resolute in their opposition to the Kirchner government over these years since the Argentinazo, and a long list of other solidarity movements extending their corn. Corn from the poorest of the poor. Corn from the people who the Popol Vuh, their sacred book, designates as the people of the corn. People made from corn. So giving this corn to the world is, in a real sense, giving themselves to the world, you know? And it was one of the most moving parts of the document. The document also, in its approximation of the Zapatista struggle, says that a very obvious fact, that this rebellion has been going on for 20 years now. Actually, when it begins in secret in 1984 in the jungle, when people don't know about it for 10 years, and then we have now 12 years of that rebellion, or we will have January 1st. So there's a long history here. In fact, it's a whole generation. And a whole generation has grown up in this rebellion. And the document says that generation is now prepared to take leadership of the EZLN, is now prepared to administrate the Caracoles and the autonomous municipalities, is now mature enough to take care of the infrastructure of autonomy. In fact, Marcos says at one point, I think it's Marcos that says this in the document, they are better Zapatistas than we are. No? And by promoting and bringing a whole new generation into the leadership of the EZLN, people that have grown up in this daily struggle, no? The comandancia, the 23 comandantes of the clandestine revolutionary indigenous committee, which has been the top echelon in the general command of the Zapatistas, are now free to do other work, no? And this other work has always been defined as falta que falta, no? What is there to do? What out there needs to be done, no? Falta que se falta, no? And this other work precisely deals with the necessity to build in Mexico a alliance, an organization of indigenous and non-indigenous people, a non-electoral alliance, an anti-capitalist alliance, an alliance that will fight for a new constitution in Mexico that will bar the outrages of neoliberalism that has indeed impoverished great numbers of people in the country. No. So that is the new job. No? And a mechanism for doing this is this kind of ingenious campaign that they've developed called La Otra Campaña, or The Other Campaign. So let me tell you a little bit about how The Other Campaign is perceived. Now, 2006 will be an extremely picoso political year in Mexico. It is a presidential election year, and it's also a year in which the electoral left, for the first time in many years, has a real chance to take the presidency of the country. And we have three major parties, the PAN in power right now, the right-wing party, Vicente Fox's party, they're going. The PRI that was in power for 71 years is trying to retake power, and the PRD, or the Party of the Democratic Revolution, the left-center party, the electoral left, that actually came close to winning the presidency in 1988, in fact did win the presidency in 1988 with Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas and was defrauded of that victory. No? This year, their candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, is way out in front in the polls by 10 points at this point. And so, you know, we have that happening, and then now we have the Zapatistas announcing that they are going to leave the jungle and travel around the country in an anti-electoral campaign, going from state to state, spending time in each one of the states, meeting with struggle organizations, bringing together this alliance of the non-electoral left, criticizing the campaigns, the parties, and the candidates themselves. The Zapatistas for many years have felt that the political parties are corrupt, they don't represent the people, and they certainly divide and contaminate indigenous communities when they come in, so they have never participated in elections. So in a real sense, this is going to be an anti-electoral campaign. As the Zapatistas move from state to state, there will be moments, we anticipate, in which all the candidates are going to coalesce in one place, and you know, then the fun is going to begin when we see the Zapatistas plus the PRI and the PRD and the other parties all campaigning in approximately the same place. No, so the other campaign is designed, as I mentioned, not to elect a candidate, but to develop a constituency for a new constitutional convention in Mexico that will create a revolutionary constitution. The Mexican constitution, written in 1917, was a revolutionary document, but it's been so amended down the years and never lived up to. So if you read the words of it, it's a great stirring document. But indeed, it's been so amended and modified that at this point it no longer serves the country at all. The new constitution is perceived as permitting ways of political participation that are not seen in the current constitution: referendum, candidates that are not parts of political parties, able to run for office, not against elections, but trying to open up the elections to non-party independent candidacies and independent movements as well. It would indeed prohibit these kind of neoliberal outrages that would privatize Mexico's oil, Pemex, the national petroleum monopoly, that would privatize the electricity generating industry, that would privatize the land. We see that happening. It would privatize the water, that is happening all over Latin America at this point. Would bar that from happening in the Constitution. And the Constitution, of course, conceived of now, and a constitutional convention will bring up many other points, we understand, but certainly a constitution that will include the San Andres Accords, the accords reached in 1996 between the Zapatistas and the federal government that guaranteed all 57 indigenous pueblos, nations, cultures in Mexico limited autonomy over their own destiny. And that would be an integral part of that constitution. So here we have the candidates out there, the parties out there, pushing for their candidacy, and the Zapatistas pushing for this new constitution on the road in Mexico all throughout 2006. And I think it's going to be an extremely interesting time. Let me show you how this is really a distinct turn for the Zapatistas. One real distinction is that in previous presidential elections, Zapatistas have done nothing at all. In 1994, they rejected the candidacy of Cuauhtemoc Cárdenas, although they endorsed their friend, the late Amado Avendaño, for governorship of Chiapas, but they stayed out of the presidential election, although the left urged them to come in. In 2000, they said very early in the game, elections are not Zapatista time, and they sat on their hands and said nothing for the entire electoral period. There was about a 10-month silence until they finally communicated again, allowing the election of the first opposition president in Mexico, a right-winger, not a left-winger, without comment, really, on the part of the Zapatistas, no? Now we look at 2006, and they're jumping into the electoral campaign to utilize it as a vehicle to criticize the electoral campaign. No? Zapatistas are often develop these proposals long before we've ever thought about them, but what an ingenious way of going. No? So the campaigns have, of course, created a great, the other campaign has created a great stir in Mexico. Again, let me go back one second to where the Zapatistas are coming from on this. No? A quick recount. 1994, the Zapatistas rise up on January 1st, 1994, in the first hour of the North American Free Trade Agreement, that beacon of globalization, no? And they demand that the government listen to them. They demand that the government fulfill their demands for housing, for health care, for education, for all those things that people need to live, to recognize the fact that they exist, 1994. They demand this of the government. In 1996, the Zapatistas reach an agreement with the Cedillo government that doesn't last long, but this agreement that developed at San Andres, the San Andres Accords, that would have guaranteed a landmark agreement that would have guaranteed autonomy over every aspect of their lives. It is signed by the government negotiators and then vetoed by the then-president Ernesto Cedillo. And for the next 6 years, the Zapatistas focus all their energies on trying to make the San Andres Accords a reality, demanding that the government and the Congress pass the San Andres Accords. And we go through a lot of different changes to get there. In 2001, they march up to Mexico City, The 23 comandantes from the clandestine Indigenous Revolutionary Committee and Su Comandante Marcos, this magnificent march of the people, the color of the earth, and go before Congress and defend their law, and Congress promptly mutilates the law. They go back to Chiapas, Congress mutilates the law, and the Zapatistas fall into a deep and long silence. And then, all of a sudden, on January 1st, 2003, Saps had not made any statements for a long time. All of a sudden, 21,000 Zapatistas appear in San Cristobal de las Casas. We spent that early morning down by the Coca-Cola plant watching the little trucks come in from the countryside. You know, they had said the Zapatistas were no longer. They'd gone away. Marcos was in Paris. There was no longer a rebellion, you know. And here were 21,000 people in their ski masks and their paliacates, their kerchiefs. The men in their rubber boots and their straw sombreros carrying a torch of pitch pine and their machetes, and the women in their, you know, beautifully embroidered huipiles. And all day they come into San Cristobal, and in the evening they begin to march into town with the torches lit, clashing their machetes together, you know. Zapata vive, la lucha si. And they arrive in the great central plaza in front of the cathedral, and there on the stage are the same comandantes that accompanied us up to Mexico City, or that we accompanied up to Mexico City, who spoke before Congress, who we hadn't seen or heard from for 18 months. And to a man and to a woman, they say, you know what? We don't need the government's permission to be autonomous. We are autonomous. And cool. It was a great moment, I tell you, you know, it was just a wonderful moment. And from there on, things changed. For the next, from 2003, January 1st, 2003, until just recently, until the sixth declaration of the Lacandon jungle, the Zapatistas went inside. Autonomy is a fiction if you don't have infrastructure. If you don't get off the government grid, and if you get off the government grid, that means you have to have alternative energy, you have to have alternative education, you have to have alternative health care, you have to develop your own alternative institutions. And with the help of non-government organizations, with the help of a good price for their organic coffee, again, a trade and fair trade developed by non-government organizations, they've been able to come up with the wherewithal to develop a very extensive system of education. Every village now has at least a primary school. High schools are being developed in all of the caracoles. There's a clinic in every one of the caracoles, and doctors that go out to all the communities working on preventable disease. And in terms of administration, they developed this whole new strata of administration that they call the Juntas de Buen Gobierno, the Commissions of Good Government, which are representatives from the 29 autonomous municipalities that come together to administrate and decide the policies of the Zapatista Army of National Liberation, the civilian policies of the EZLN. All of this has required a lot of attention inside. It has been an interior move into the heart of Zapatismo. And there are many that have accused the EZLN in the last bunch of years of not caring about national and international politics anymore because they've gone inside. So in a real sense, the sexta, which says we're going out into the country, is a way of another step in the cycle, a way of moving outside now into national and international politics. And I think that's, you know, I'm kind of an historian of this movement, and I see that as being extremely significant in the Zapatista development over the next bunch of years. Now, the shape of the sexta of the other campaign was developed at a series of meetings in the cañadas, or the canyons leading down to the Lacandon jungle, in August and September of this year. And there were six different meetings, each with a distinct constituency: farmers, indigenous people, students, workers, cultural workers. And then there were a series of meetings that were just for individuals and families, and the last meeting was for the rest of us. Los que sobran, huh? And at each one of these meetings, people came from all over Mexico, thousands of people, and took their turn at the microphone proposing what the shape of the other campaign should be. And these were 48-hour gab fests in the middle of the pouring rain in the jungle with the mud up to your neck. The comandantes would come to each one of the events. We hadn't seen Subcomandante Marcos for 4 years since the march in 2001. And they would come and sit down and take extensive notes on what everybody was saying, because there were many proposals. They brought with them, it became kind of the mascot of these meetings, was a kind of mutilated chicken. I guess that's what it was. It didn't walk too well and it had funny arms and it was black and white. And the Zapatistas said it was a penguin. No? The penguin, el pingüino of the Lacandon jungle, no? And they would arrive at every one of the meetings. Marcos or one of the compañeros would be carrying the penguin in, you know. And the penguin would be put at the table where the Zapatistas sat while they were taking notes and listening to it, and would walk up and down the table throughout the meetings, you know. There's always an element of surrealism in what the EZLN does, you know. The final shape of the other campaign was developed at a plenary session, September 16th, 17th, Mexican Independence Day, in the Caracol Autonomous Municipality of Francisco Gómez. And let me just give you what it looks like, you know, so you get some physical idea of how this thing is going to work. On January 1st, the 12th anniversary of the Zapatista uprising in that first hour of NAFTA, the first comandantes will leave from San Cristobal. Subcomandante Marcos will be the first with a delegation called the Commission of the Sixth Declaration, the Sexta Commission. We don't know how many comandantes are going to be in that. There will be 16 people in all. And they will travel around first the state of Chiapas, a very dangerous part of this trip because there's a lot of enmity in various parts of Chiapas, creating meeting with other struggle organizations, creating alliances, talking about creating a non-electoral campaign during the 2006 campaign. January 1st is also the day that the official campaigns begin, so this is absolutely parallel. They'll spend a week in Chiapas, then they'll go out to the Yucatan, spending a week in each state on the Yucatan to Tabasco, up to Veracruz, come across the Isthmus at the narrowest point of Mexico to Oaxaca, travel throughout Oaxaca for a week, go up to the Altiplano to Puebla, travel around all of Central and Mexico in each state again, spending a week in each place, meeting with struggle organizations and developing this alliance. Come to Mexico City the last 2 weeks in April. Those people that are interested in coming down and taking a look at what's going on, they'll be in and around Mexico City and Mexico State from the 15th of April to the end of the month. And then they will, all of this is territory that they covered in the march in 2001. They'll then begin to take new territory by going north from Mexico City, reaching the border, going state by state and reaching the border in June of this year. The election is in July. There will be two major meetings with La Otra Campaña en el Otro Lado, the other campaign in the other side in the U.S., when Chicanos and Mexicanos living in the U.S. are invited to Ciudad Juarez and to Tijuana for two sessions to develop the campaign on both sides of the border. Zapatistas will then fly back, they'll go back to Mexico City for a mass rally on June 24th, a week before the election. It will be at the same time that the other campaigns are closing, and they always close with a great rally in the Zocalo. So we'll see the PAN one day, and the PRI one day, and the PRD the next day, and the Zapatistas. So, you know, we'll get some idea of what kind of effect it's had on the country in terms of looking at the numbers. The Zapatistas will then return to Chiapas for the election, which is the first week in July, await the results, analyze the results, and because this is not an electoral campaign, but an anti-electoral campaign, because they're not trying to elect a candidate, they will start out again in September of 2006 with other comandantes who will again travel the same route around the country, forming the basis for the calling of a constitutional convention, and that phase of the other campaign will end in March of 2007. So if you've got nothing to do for the next couple of years, this is going to be an interesting trip. Now, the other campaign has, of course, raised a great deal of noise in Mexico, and a lot of people really don't like it, no? The PRI and the PAN and the Zapatistas are natural-born enemies, and, you know, they hate each other, so whatever the EZLN will say about the PRI and the PAN is kind of expected. But where the problem seems to be focusing at this point is with the Party of the Democratic Revolution and its candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Andrés Manuel López Obrador, as I mentioned, is now the leading candidate for the presidency in Mexico and has been so for the last 3 years, no? He's the ex-mayor of Mexico City. He developed a tremendous constituency in Mexico City, servicing old people, for example, people that never received a penny from the government now get a $60 a month pension. It's not very much, but, you know, at least it's something. He's done a lot in terms of public transportation in Mexico. He's a very good mayor and a very, very popular mayor. Not necessarily a leftist, but a very popular mayor. So popular that indeed the PAN and the PRI tried to exclude him from the ballot in 2006 and developed these phony charges to try and keep him off the ballot. And lo and behold, last April 24th, I had the great privilege of marching through the streets of Mexico City with 1.2 million people in support of Andrés Manuel López Obrador. That was on a Sunday. By Wednesday of that week, the government had dropped the charges. No. So just to give you some idea that he's tremendously popular as a candidate. But this other campaign is really directed at winning the hearts and minds of the left. No. To say that, you know, elections really don't prove anything. They might improve anything for a second, but people get corrupted when they're in power. They make a lot of promises. They never deliver on those promises. And power really comes from down below. Power comes from us organizing. When we take a factory, when we take a plaza, when we take the streets, we really have power. And we have to understand that we have that power down below without electing people to office who will then tell us what to do. No? So, you know, there's kind of two ideologies working here. One is power from down below, and the other is power from above. And the Zapatistas are going to focus a lot of criticism on the left, on the electoral left, on Andrés Manuel López Obrador. It's begun already. They've accused AMLO, or his initials, of nefarious crimes. Doesn't hold up, really. You know, to say that the Party of the Democratic Revolution voted against the Indian Rights Bill in 2001 is only half true. Half of the delegation in the Senate voted for it, or against the bill, but for the government's bill, and the PRD walked out of the lower house, the Cámara de Diputados. So, you know, it's an accusation that doesn't stand up entirely. And to say that Andrés Manuel López Obrador is surrounded by PRIistas and Salinistas is also a critique of the Zapatistas, and it's true. A lot of people in this campaign came out of the PRI. In fact, the entire Party of the Democratic Revolution came out of the PRI. So, you know, again, this is a criticism that it's there, but it's got some water, but it doesn't hold all of the water, no? But the idea, again, is we're dealing with trying to win people's ideas that elections are not the whole ball of wax, that in fact we have this kind of power, the left has that kind of power, and developing a left that has that kind of consciousness, no? And there's going to be, as I say, a lot of back and forth. Already the Zapatistas are being accused of throwing the election to the PRI. No? Very much like Ralph Nader was accused in 2000 of having thrown the election to George Bush. Well, we all know that those allegations never stood up. The Democrats actually won the election if they had asked the right questions in Florida, and Ralph Nader in no way, shape, or form stole the election for George Bush. And the Zapatistas in no way, shape, or form are going to steal this election for the PRI. Indeed, a pre-victory is an outcome, a scenario that we need to really consider as a distinct possibility. The PRI is a national party. It's got power in all of these states. It's got a terrible candidate, a guy named Roberto Madrazo, who indeed, López Obrador and Madrazo are both from the state of Tabasco, and they both fought for the governorship of that state. We know that Madrazo is a low-down, dirty dog. No. A man that has stolen every election he's ever won, no? And because the party is a national party, there's a distinct chance that they will be able to mobilize enough votes to take the presidency again. If that happens, things are not going to be good for the Zapatistas. The election of the PRI in 2006 will not only freeze this heroic phrase called the democratic transition, which has never been democratic and never transisted, or whatever it is, you know, but, you know, will stop this movement in Mexico, glacial movement towards democracy, and will certainly animate the paramilitaries against the Zapatistas in the state of Chiapas, and will also animate the hard-hearted militaries that from the beginning have demanded that the Zapatistas be liquidated. So a pre-victory is very dangerous for the EZLN. How this thing will shake down? I don't know. I mean, I'm good at telling you what happened, but I'm not real good at telling you what's going to happen. I would look towards the mass meeting on June 24th, the week before the election in Mexico City, when Marcos will perhaps say to his constituency, well, if you think that voting will change anything, go ahead and do it. He did that in 2000 at the last moment, no? But I think we'll see over the months a lot of animosity between these two, and perhaps some, you know, fisticuffs at some point. If the two wind up in the same place, the constituencies of both parts may well go at it. So it's going to be a hot time over the next couple of months. Finally, I want to point out that this election is taking place in Mexico, but the Mexican election is not the only election on the continent this year or next year in 2006. There will be 12 presidential and parliamentary elections in Latin America next year. And we're talking about Brazil, we're talking about Argentina, we're talking about all of these key places, including Bolivia, if they allow the elections to take place, no? So what happens in Mexico is going to have a lot of resonance throughout the rest of the continent. The Zapatista narrative is well known throughout Latin America. I think I've, in other talks, talked about traveling through Peru and Bolivia and Ecuador last year, and understanding that everyone knew their story, that the Zapatistas were a symbol for all of Latin America. So people are going to be looking at what happens with the other campaign in terms of their own electoral campaign. In Latin America, we've seen what could be described as a sea change. The continent is suffering the brunt of neoliberal reforms that have left millions of people disprotected, has swung to the left, to the social democratic left. We see, of course, Kirchner in Argentina, and Lula in Brazil, and Tabaré Vázquez in Uruguay, El Comandante Chávez in Venezuela. We'll see Evo Morales in Bolivia if they allow the election to happen, and we may very well see Andrés Manuel López Obrador in Mexico. No, I'm not saying that Andrés Manuel López Obrador is Hugo Chávez, as Fox said the other day, and Madrazo as well, but, you know, it's part of that alignment. The problem with that alignment, with the social democratic left, with the people that have taken power electorally in Latin America, is they have very little room to maneuver in. They take over government structures that are entwined, entangled in agreements with the World Trade Organization, with the World Bank, with the International Monetary Fund, with the White House. They have no room to move. And so the promises they make of reform are blunted. And the people of Latin America are not very satisfied with this. So under these circumstances, the Zapatistas' appeal, which says, look, we do have the power down below. We don't have to go through this whole electoral process in order to be able to demonstrate the fact that we have power. We already have it. We're already autonomous. We already have this within ourselves. Is going to have a lot of echo throughout all of Latin America in the coming year. They've developed a network throughout the country, beginning with the referendum in 1999, where they had to go to all over Mexico, send 5,000 representatives to every municipality in Mexico to make contacts with local struggles. So those contacts were established first in 1999. They were reinforced in 2001 with the March of the People of the Color of the Earth. And through the meetings that were held in the jungle in August and September, they were again reinforced. So all these contacts with struggle organizations around the country have been established. And basically what that means is logistically lining it up. Where do we go from here to here? How do we get from there to here? And so that's what the process is right now, is connecting the dots, you know, between one place or another. I think it's important to understand that the media attention is really going to be a vital factor here. If the Zapatistas do this and no one knows about it, it's not going to be a successful other campaign. And already we begin to see with La Jornada, for example, which is the left newspaper in Mexico that has carried the news of the Zapatista rebellion from one end of the rebellion to the next for the last 12 years, but is a PRD-run newspaper affiliated with the Party of the Democratic Revolution. And we see that the notice of the Zapatistas' other campaign is way in the back of the paper now. And Andrés Manuel López Obrador's campaign is right in the first 10 pages. So fighting for space in the media is going to be important as the campaign gets underway. One question in the back?
Yeah, just one more. Is it true that the Sexta came out in solidarity for the Cuban Revolution?
Oh, yeah.
The revolution that has state power?
Yeah, I know. But it wasn't with the Cuban Revolution. It was with the Cuban people. No? And the Zapatistas don't talk much about Cuba and haven't talked much about Cuba over the years. And you know, I got this kind of glimmer when they directly referred to the Cuban people that, you know, things are going to change in Cuba pretty soon. Fidel is not going to be with us forever. And there's going to be a battle on for the hearts and minds of the Cuban people as well. You know? So it was kind of like opening up this conduit to Cuba, because the Zapatistas really don't talk about Cuba at all and haven't in the past. Some people came with songs, and other people came with poems, and other people came with political theater, and, you know, there was a lot of different ways of voicing your solidarity with the Sixth Declaration and talking about plans for what the other campaign would look like. So it was as much a cultural event as it was this political event, and that's always true of Zapatista events. No? There's a question down here. Arnie, did you have a question?
And the church, John. The church.
The church what?
Where are they going to be?
Should we get down and pray? Wait. No.
You know, they usually help push things to the right, don't you?
Well, not. You know, in Chiapas, we have a different church. We have a liberation church, which is essentially controlled by the flock, the people down below, not the hierarchy and not the bishops. We have a bishop in San Cristobal that's kind of middle of the road, but he comes up on the right side a lot of times. What they always say about the church in Chiapas, not the rest of the church, but what they say about the church in Chiapas is that it has the force of transforming the bishop. And it certainly happened with our great Bishop Emeritus Samuel Ruiz. No, and we saw that happen with his coadjutor, Raul Vera, and to some extent we see that happening with Arismendi. But the church has, you know, they've kind of endorsed the Zapatistas going out into the country because it looks like they're joining the political process, no? So they kind of like that because it looks like they're going to be part of, they don't really get the idea that this is an anti-electoral campaign. But I know that the Cardinal of Mexico City made that endorsement. There's a question right there.
Yeah, maybe it's my old-fashioned leftist background, but I'm trying to understand, what is the Zapatistas' attitude towards state power, and do they believe that they can coexist with a capitalist, proletarianist state?
Okay, well, we've expected this question for a long time, since we get it every time. And we're not going to go any further than this. You know, the Zapatistas are not Marxist-Leninists, as I have said at every one of these performances or presentations or whatever they are, and you know I'm going to say that. The Zapatistas believe that state power is not something to be fought for, that indeed the state no longer has any credibility, that the state lies to you, that the state is deeply in debt, that state in Mexico and in other countries in Latin America have been annexed by the United States, by the White House, and that no one believes in the state any longer and it no longer functions. And so why take state power? No, when we have the power down below. Now, I'm going to stop right there, and I'm not going to take a second question, because we always do this. Yeah.
Okay. I was there in the 16th and 17th, yeah. And we started off with a huge chant, workers and peasants to power.
Yeah.
And there was some anarchist got up and said, almost in the style of say, but he wanted to exclude everybody who was in favor of taking power. And of course, he was booed down, because it was kind of a Stalinist anarchist thing to try to propose.
This was the meeting when there were photos of Joe Stalin, actually, weren't there?
Yeah,
there were portraits of Joe Stalin on the, yeah, at this meeting. Unbelievable.
I think the issue with a constitution now, uh-huh, building a national movement, not just caracoles, a national movement does raise the question of power. The question is, the programs of the left are from 50 years ago, and what Marcos, I believe, is trying to do is develop a program from the people, listening from the people, developing a program so that it's a program that relates not to the Russian Revolution but to the Mexican people themselves. But it's a revolutionary program, and a revolutionary program is going to face either they take power or they will be wiped out.
I wanted to say this, you know, there's something about the Zapatistas that have this power of transformation, of being able to change people. I've known Earl Gilman for how many years? 40 years now? I have never heard you say anything like this at all. There is a power of transformation here. Let's hear it for Earl Gilman. Okay, where are we on time? We still have some time for questions. Yeah.
I'm sure you've been following the corruption campaign the corruption scandal in Brazil with Lula and the Workers' Party. I'm just curious how that's played out in Mexico and whether or not that's affected the PRD and the electoral strategies in Mexico.
It's a good question. The connection between Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas and Lula was very close. And Cárdenas is still thinking about being a candidate in this election. And precisely because Lula won on his fourth try, you know. So there is a lot of attention, a lot of disappointment that has evolved from the situation, as all of us have been disappointed by the fact that there was a naked distribution of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars in order to buy votes without trying to convince people that grow out of both the Workers' Party and Lula's administration. It's really serious for the Brazilian left and for all of the left in Latin America. This should never have happened. I think we also have to say, why did it happen? Why this information suddenly blossomed and became this debilitating scandal in Brazil? It is not in the United States' interest to allow Lula to continue in Brazil. And there are a lot of people that have been saying that the second term of Lula would be the radical term, that the first 4 years were the term that would be the one that would set the stage, and the next 4 years would be the one where the transformation would occur. Fray Beto has said this on a number of occasions, and we're waiting to see if that will happen. You may also know that in the last couple of days, there's been this fiery back and forth between Mexico's erstwhile outgoing president, thank God, Vicente Fox, and Comandante Chavez, who had the audacity to criticize Mexico for representing the United States' views at Mar del Plata, no? And El Comandante has been given the president, what, for? Diplomatic relations could be broken by tomorrow. There was an ultimatum set by the Mexican Secretary of Foreign Relations today, and diplomatic relations could occur tomorrow. You tell me who's engineering that situation, and I will point to Mr. Bush in the White House, of course, no? So, you know, Mexico always serves this position representing the U.S. in these trade talks, you know, and they're perceived that way in South America as being the stalking horse of the U.S. And this time, you know, they ran into a developing market in Latin America, the Mercosur, and they weren't going to budge on this issue, and they're not going to budge on this issue, no matter what Fox, trying to get 29, you know, subservient countries together that have an economy that represents 1/100th of the Brazilian and Argentinian economy.
John, ALBA's on the table now. That's what I tried to say earlier. Uh-huh. And I think that that's what's also happening. It isn't just against the free trade agreement of the Americas, but the idea of a trade agreement without the United States.
Right.
And without the stalking horse of Mexico or Fox.
Uh-huh. Well.
And Chavez and Cuba are taking the lead on that, and that more and more countries are interested in this type of an agreement.
Good. Great.
And the United States is scared to death.
Yeah, and we're all scared to death of free trade, or whatever it is, you know. So, you know, it hasn't been good for Mexico. We've lost 3 million farmers who've been forced off their land, you know. Counting 5,000 dead trying to come across this border since NAFTA was signed. People that were forced off their land or lost their jobs and had to migrate to this country. So free trade has not been anything good at all for Mexico.
You have been listening to John Ross, award-winning journalist, activist, poet, human shield, and globe-trotting troublemaker, presenting a lecture updating the ongoing Zapatista rebellion in Chiapas and its plans for Mexico's 2006 presidential election. The talk was recorded on November 14th of 2005 at the New College Theater in San Francisco, California. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.